The Grade Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a grade cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the grade cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel a gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
The Great Cricketer Podcast is back on Fox Sports. It's a huge show this week. Pat Cummins is on the program. And, of course, Sydney Morning Herald journalist Andrew Wu as well. We're talking Ashes. We're a little bit closer to the Ashes this week, boys. Shield, that's starting. Western Australia won a title, apparently. There's the whole Ed Cowan situation. That started right here. So I suppose we just get right into it. My name is Ian Higgins. I'm joined, as ever, by Sam Perry and, of course, Dave Edwards. Chaps, welcome to week two of the summer.
Hi, Ian. What a wonderful introduction again. You're really selling the game. I think for a week where really nothing's happened, you've made it sound like there's a lot happening in cricket, and I suppose that's half the battle with broadcasting. Well done.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's good to be back. And also, I also like that you said the Cowan thing started here, like we've claimed a scalp. Mm. You know, like we're really starting to kind of manipulate the news media, and hopefully we can keep that going. So, I mean, like, can we recap? He goes,
"Yeah, of course we can, mate."
Last week, it was all about Warner saying that he had to find hatred to even play the code. He's since come out and said he probably could have chosen his words better there, but the damage has been done because you know, Trescothick came out and said that was a disgrace or something to that effect, and you know, England got to moralise again, all while they stay eerily silent about Ben Stokes.
Yeah, well, that's sort of the weird thing, isn't it, Pez? I mean, because there's so much of Australian chat already. Obviously, we're immersed in it being in Australia. For those who don't know, Sam is in London, so he's getting that media train. But, like, there's nothing coming out of England. Like, no one's saying anything, and I'm worried. Like, silence is you know, it's like when you tell the girl that you've been seeing for 3 weeks that you love her, and you're just waiting for that text back, because that's how you tell someone you love them, over text.
Yeah. And you can see that they're typing, they're thinking about it, but they're not actually sending it.
You see those three grey dots, yeah.
It's definitely a strategy, isn't it, though? They're letting us dig our own graves. I mean, we're trying to, I guess, cricket in the news now. It's the inter-season. Football's finished. Now we've got to create headlines where we can. And, you know, you can see it every day. There's a new story coming out. But England, suspiciously silent, letting us dig our own graves.
I do like the metaphor of the three grey dots. Also, just to give some correspondence from London, Tottenham are just on the march as well in the Premier League, and that pretty much just takes all of the news cycles. So that might be another reason why they're not saying anything.
Yeah, it's funny, Pez, because Australia won an irrelevant Bledisloe Cup match 6 weeks after the second one. They won the third one in Brisbane, and you think that'd be the big news, but Dave Warner's declared war on England for some reason, and that's kind of now the big story. But I don't know. I'm just do you guys worry about England's lack of correspondence? Why aren't they returning our calls?
I'd love to hear more from them. I mean, when are they coming here? Do we know actually when they're arriving? When are those blokes getting here?
Apparently, they do a pretty good job of keeping that under wraps. So, like, I think they, you know, and any listeners out there who care, you know, want to inform us, please let us know. But even talking to a couple of cricket writers, apparently they're very good at keeping it under wraps. They normally do some sort of camp in Portugal or Spain or something like that, or Dubai, and they'll sort of, they'll obviously fly in under a cloak of darkness.
Right.
I know a couple of their journos are over there already.
Yeah. They haven't booked their flights. I mean, it's like last minute sky scan stuff. They're just looking for the cheapest flight from England to Australia.
They're going to arrive here on Zoosk. Is this a bit like
Zeusk, isn't that a dating app?
That's definitely a dating app, he goes.
So I'm scammed just one too, I believe. I don't know why I know so much about it.
Is this a bit like, I mean, Australia has a World Cup qualifier against Honduras coming up, and there's sort of talk about Australia. They arrive, and like the home team, the Honduras will know when Australia gets into the airport, and it's going to be like rocks thrown at the bus and stuff. But like the tactic is that they sort of they exit through the back door of the airport. Like, is that how England are going to arrive here, like through the country? Are they going to arrive by boat, like the old times?
Wouldn't, I mean, if I ever had my choice of how to arrive for an Ashes series, it definitely wouldn't be anything happening in the 21st century or even late 20th century. It would definitely have been the 2-week boat where all manner of things happened, particularly under Don Bradman's watch.
Yeah. A lot of blokes didn't even make it. You know, they got pushed over the edge. Just throw them into the deep end. Absolutely. Never heard from them again, but I mean, England won't be coming here by boat. They'll be coming by plane, and we don't really know what to expect from them. So hopefully Andrew Wu later can shed a bit of light on what's going on, because we'd love to hear from them. Three dots at the moment, nothing.
Chaps, in the spirit of moving things along, I just want to speak arrogantly to you about our book coming out today. We record this on a Wednesday night. It's October 25, 2017. We've got a second book and it's come out today. Are you excited?
Oh, absolutely. Here goes. And we must apologise now for the relentless promotion on social media. We have been selling out for our 30 cents a book for every book purchased, depending on the platform that you purchase it from. Royalties are higher for ebooks, just FYI. But we do apologise. It is off brand for us to be pushing a product because 5 years of goodwill. Hopefully you'll excuse us for that. But the book comes out today as we speak. So you'll be able to pop down to your local store if you're in Australia tomorrow and pick it up. Tea and No Sympathy. He goes. You and I actually went down to George Street Dimmicks today. We were hoping the book would be there. Launch day, Sydney's biggest bookstore, looked on the shelves, nothing, checked the system, no record of it, asked a bloke about it, he looked it up, couldn't find anything. Apparently 100 or so books are just lying on the floor somewhere, and some blokes just got to bend down and put them on the shelf. So hopefully they'll be there in stores tomorrow for all of you.
I don't even know if this is worse, Dave and Higos, but firstly, that's a great introduction to the book industry there, so yeah, please support it voraciously. But more than that, so I'm here in London, just to repeat that again, but my dad works in the city, and this is my dad who still hasn't been convinced that the character in the book isn't written after him. It is not. I'm just being very clear about that. I get on very well with my dad, but he works in the city, and I softly, gently suggested to him that, if he popped by a Dimmicks on George Street at lunchtime, he might see, a book with his son's name on it and, hopefully be proud of me. So I haven't heard from him. And
just on that, Pez, I actually, there was a book review that came out today that I forwarded to my dad via email, and he wrote back, good review, going to be published anywhere. So obviously he doesn't deem a book review on the internet to mean anything. Only means something if it's in the actual paper, despite the decline of traditional print journalism and all that.
Dave, can we talk about when you and I walked into the bookstore and as you said, we couldn't find it. The first book's still selling though, which is a weird thing, but so you can get that as well if you want. When you spoke to the chap in Dimmicks and you said, yeah, we're just looking for the Great Cricketer's new book, and it's just a weird thing we have to pretend like you don't know anything about it. And the guy said to you, can you just give me what's the author's name, because I might cross reference it. And then you had to say, I think it's Dave Edwards.
just had to pretend that I wasn't there. Just self-aggrandizement writ large, and then, checking whether my book is in a store.
And then for whatever reason, it's under my name. And it says, oh, yeah, I see it now. Ian Higgins. Yeah. And I'm just standing there as if I just, he's not just saying my own name. It was a weird experience, but yeah. Anyway, so
I just like that you guys are pretending that we don't all do that most days in bookstores in relation to our book.
If anyone wants a book signed, that's where I'll be from about 10 a.m. to 3 to 5. We thought that this might be a good opportunity, though, to introduce the hashtag Thanks Cricket. So if you do already have your copy of your book, those who have pre-ordered it, I suspect you may already have it by the time you listen to this. But if you want to send us your darkest memories with a picture of you holding the book and using the hashtag Thanks Cricket, we might collate all those and give you a little shout out. So that's the idea of it. Andrew Wu coming up.
It has been referred to as the best sports writing tribute to a particular sport since Fever Pitch.
Does it do anything to enhance literature? It would be another question.
I wouldn't even call it literature, really.
Okay, well, boys, last week we had Adam Collins on the show as part of a new element of the Great Cricketer podcast, where we actually get people on that know about the game and follow it professionally to add some detail to the stuff that we partly know about. This week we've got a bloke on who is one of the best sports writers in the country, one of the best young sports writers in the country, I would say. One story about him I have is when we had a brief opportunity to join the press box last year, this guy was straight up next to me following a story about someone doctoring scorecards in grade cricket, which eventually reached his column the next day. I'm talking about Andrew Wu, sports writer at the Sydney Morning Herald. He joins us on the Grade Cricketer podcast. Hello, Wooey, and can I call you Wooey?
You certainly can. Also, I like your introduction about being one of the best young sports writers in the country. So that's wrong on both counts. I'm the young or the best.
Oh, that's very
not only are you one of the best young sports writers in the country, you've also got one of the greatest salads or heads of hair in the cricket press pack, I think. We haven't seen you in a little while. Were you still going for the shaggy look, or have you got a more streamlined salad that you're going to be debuting this summer?
Salad.
I was a little bit more salt and pepper this summer compared to last.
All right.
You should get all the look from year to year. You'd see a little bit more grey get on. I think this year it's going to be. Well, I haven't had a cut for this year, so I have a cut.
Well, can't wait. Your physical appearance aside, we thought we'd get your take on the Cowan situation. We've obviously described it in a little bit of detail prior to now, but. With your privileged position as a sports writer close to the scene, I mean, is there anything you're picking up from this situation? I mean, what are the implications for cricket in Australia in relation to this policy that they're pursuing of youth over excellence?
It's probably the same about, every week there's really only 66 spots for to play first-class cricket. And, some states are better than others. You're not necessarily going to get the 66 best cricketers playing. And the first round of the Shield, when you've got the national team all available, it magnifies that situation. So I've spoken to a few people who reckon that it's time that Cricket Australia looked at maybe introducing another team. And I mean, that concept has been floated about in the past. We've seen the CA11 brought in with much controversy as well. But I think they did a little bit better this summer compared to last summer in the One Day Cup. So, I mean, that's one situation that probably could be looked at. I guess one of the reasons against it might be, the tradition of the Sheffield Shield. But a lot would argue that, that tradition's really been in the last few years with all these different rules that they've brought in, different point scoring system that one more might not actually make all that much of a difference, particularly if it gives an extra 11 points a chance to play first class cricket.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we are in an environment where we have to come up with new solutions to keep cricket relevant. But this is a particularly remarkable situation because Australia finds themselves in a scenario where they are probably short a batsman or two in the test side, and yet the top run scorer in that competition that delivers batsmen can't get a game. So maybe it is just about having another team.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't see too many competitions in Australia, certainly, where you've got, Ed Cowan's probably, you'd say maybe he's the, in that 20 to 30 bracket, he's in the top 30 players in the Shield if you're being conservative. You wouldn't have too many competitions where your 30th best player doesn't get a Guernsey for the first 3 weeks of the season, unless they're injured. So it probably speaks volumes about cricket and sort of how it's run and the competition and sort of maybe it's in need of a bit of a change.
Moving things along, Wooey, your reputation precedes you. There's been a lot of talk here in the UK about, the worry that particularly if Stokes goes along to England, which looks less likely as the days trickle on. But whatever the case, that when the English guys go over for the Ashes, that they get a really hard time from the Australian press. I don't want to paint you as the guy leading the charge there, but, you know, I've heard rumours doing the rounds of the Australian press pack, you know, sitting down for beers and working out how to make life as difficult as possible for, you know, the English side and for touring sides. I mean, is this going to be like, you know, Australia versus Honduras, as Higo's alluded to earlier? I mean, are you going to sort of hound them the way that the Honduras people might hound the Australian Socceroos soon?
Just a few guys have just left my place when we just had a barbecue discussing the same thing about how we're going to stitch England up. So, I mean, in all seriousness, there is an element of rough reception for the Palms when they come over here. But in terms of whether the journalists are out to get them, I mean, I'm not sure that's entirely true. I think if the team is losing, and it's like four summers ago when it was 5-0, then I think there's an element of enjoying England's downfall. But I'm sure the previous time they came over here when they absolutely smashed Australia, there was a lot of talk the other way, you know, pumping them up about how much better they were, how much better their system was, etc. So you
won't be trying any kind of dirty news of the world tactics, you know, setting up honey traps in hotel rooms and hidden cameras and microphones to kind of catch them off guard. Any of that kind of Piers Morgan stuff?
I don't think they have the money for hidden cameras.
I know our mobile line isn't really that good, so we'll probably cut it short there. But we really appreciate you joining us to give some insight into how you are, but not really, are going to make life hell for English players. But also a couple of ideas on, you know, how we can make sure that guys that do really well in Shield cricket actually get to play the game as a reward. So
yeah, that'd be good.
Cheers for coming on the Great Cricketer podcast, mate.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for having me.
This summer, we've got the biggest renovation challenge yet. Two teams will have to transform not one, but two broken down grade cricket dressing rooms every single week. There will be tension.
What even is grade cricket, Dazza? Why did we take time off work to do this?
Come on, Charlesy. Work hard, love.
There will be drama.
I just want to make this perfect. Great cricket deserves a great home.
But when the reveal comes, there will be joy.
Oh God. Lads. Boys. Look at this, eh? Results. Results.
Ever since the missus booted me out and took the kids, I've been sleeping in this dressing room. It's a second home to me, literally. So this is really special.
For us to be able to come in and give these grade cricketers a beautiful new dressing room, one they can drink their beers in, sing the club song, judge each other in the showers, yeah, you know, it makes you feel good.
But this ain't no charity. Not when the stakes are this high.
I'm not here for a bloody holiday. If I wanted that, I would have gone to Bali or Thailand.
It's Australia's toughest renovation competition. Winner takes all.
If I have to dish out a little bit of chin music, I will.
Presented by Australia's favourite knockabout blue-collared larrikin millionaire.
We're giving great cricket the reno makeover it deserves.
Reno Rampage. Coming soon.
Well, boys, I think the guy that we've got on today is probably the best cricketer that we've had on. Definitely the best contemporary cricketer we've had on. Definitely the best looking cricketer we've ever had on as well. And I do want to focus a lot on that throughout this interview.
Brendan Julian might have something to say about that, mate.
Good point, actually.
Come on.
We'll have to ask him, although he hasn't spoken to us in about a year, has he? BJ, if you're listening, please. Reply to my text.
Please call us.
No, of course, I'm talking about Pat Cummins, Australian speedster, all-round great bloke. Pat, welcome to the Grade Cricketer.
Well, thanks for having me. And I know you had Eddie Cowan on last week, so hopefully he's not listening in this week. Great intro.
We did say that we didn't want to create any clickbait from his interview, but it was quite the opposite. But we'll see how we go here, Pat. But we normally start with grade cricket, you know, given the name of the show and all. So we'll do that here. And what we normally do is ask people what grade cricket means to them. And before I do that, I'm kind of reminded of the chat that we had, as in Dave, Ian and I, with Brad Haddon last year. And he said he played fifth grade, then he went straight to first grade and has never known what happens at any other level. You were picked for Australia at 18, so I'm guessing you don't even know what grade cricket is.
Yeah, it's a thing you have to bring afternoon tea to, isn't it?
Have you ever brought afternoon tea in your life?
Yeah, I actually played on the weekend. I bought some dips and jats, which is, okay. Is actually probably better than I'm not. At one stage,
Was it Yumi's dip? Sorry to deviate.
It was actually. It was the hummus, the Yumi hummus, and
yep.
I think it was the old chili filly.
Good.
But there was a stage where I was playing with my brothers and we used to go through the Macca's drive-thru and get a couple of boxes of Macca's cookies, and that was our contribution each week. So it's improved a little bit.
And so beyond bringing afternoon tea to grade cricket, Pat, do you have any thoughts on playing yourself? I mean, have you played a lot of grade cricket as someone who played for Australia at 18, or do you just bring afternoon tea?
Now, I played a full season of fourth grade, and then a season of second grade, and then about half a season of first grade before getting the call up. But when I first started playing, I guess I was probably only 15 or 16 grade cricket. Geez, it really opened my eyes pretty quickly. you go from playing with people your age to running their 20s and 30s, and you kind of find out what happens in the real world. So that's what I used to look forward to most, was going and sitting in the corner quietly listening to all the stories.
Yeah, do you remember like the first time you walked into an adult change room? I'm obviously being a young man, young boy growing up playing kids cricket and such, and then that first time that you walked into that grade cricket change room in fourth grade, can you run us through, I guess, how you were received, the kind of men that were in that change room, the state of dress they were in?
I mean, there was always a couple of people with the brown paper bags full of McDonald's that they picked up on the way. But then I remember my first season was everyone brought towels to the ground, and it took me a little while to work out that you meant a shower at the ground afterwards. That was the biggest, eye-opener for me.
Yeah, before the game.
Once the last ball's bowled, that isn't the day over. That's... there's still a whole process to go through after the game. So that was the biggest thing different for me, I think.
I've never heard showers referred to as a process, but I think that's exactly what they are. They're like a social process in Australia. And a frightening one too. Pat, I mean, I'm just referring to something I saw last week. It was a fairly soft, kind of muddled, overwritten piece about you in The Guardian from someone. But I read in it that your brothers claimed to a TV crew that even though you'd played for Australia, they could still beat you in the backyard. So I'm just wondering if you could outline to us and to the listeners your backyard setup and sort of spare no details, sort of the ball, the pitch, the rules. How did the Cummins household do it?
Yeah, so I've got two older brothers, a couple of years older than me, and my oldest one's about 6 years older. And we had a decent-sized backyard. It was probably about 20 metres long. So your standard pitch length, but we needed a run-up. So the pitch ended up being about 6 metres long with about a 15-metre run-up. And we used to mow the wicket on level one on the mower before we bowled every, a nice strip down the middle, get a hose on it, make it nice and wet, and then used to get a Shane Warne ball, and that was our ball. So you'd charge in, slight downhill as well. And it was, we used to reckon a gutsy 10 there was worth a test 100 on any ground.
Oh, so runs were hard to come by in your backyard, because for me, 300s weren't uncommon, so you had to really cool down on things.
Yeah, no, it was all about the bowlers in ours. And really the only way he could score runs was hitting it straight back past the bowler. So, well,
it's where you learned how to bowl bounces.
Learn how to bowl bounces and haven't found a back foot in my batting yet, so put it down in the backyard.
So just for the listeners as well, Pat, the Shane Warne ball you refer to are the sort of the yellow rubbery things that had the Shane Warne released, or you know, his people released, that told you where to put your fingers to grip it for leg spin. You never wanted to do that. You just wanted to bowl pace, and then your brothers faced Pat Cummins downhill for their whole lives from 6 metres.
Yeah, I tried leg spin, but I was terrible. So yeah, that was really the only other option. But any of those variations of the balls, that was one of them. But I think there was Kenga cricket, those types of balls. So whenever we go into a clinic, or you know, that's where you try and fill up your bag, fill up a couple more for the backyard.
Pat, have you always been quick? I'm just trying to think. Like I faced guys who played fifth grade every other weekend, 35 k's quicker in the nets, and I'm just wondering what it's like to actually face someone who bowls generally 155 k's in a cricket match. How quick that is actually in the nets. Like, have you always been quick? Do guys not want to face you in the nets?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I reckon everyone feels that much quicker in the nets. But yeah, hard to say. I mean, some of the guys, like we had just in New South Wales training today, we had big Dougie Bollinger steaming in. Joshy Hazelwood and Starkey, I mean, they bowl really fast, but in the nets with a pink ball, that was you wouldn't put worse than me through that.
That's not fun.
So yeah, I don't know, it was the nets being enclosed around you, but yeah. It's not fun. I'd much prefer facing anyone in the game.
When was the first time you really realised that you were quick, that you were legitimately quick? Did this sort of develop you? Like, or did you know when you were like 10 that you were legitimately, like, people don't want to face you?
I think it was probably under 10s or 11s. And you only play the same, there's probably only four or five club teams that you play every year. And yeah. I reckon I retired this one bloke. He was only small, I reckon about 3 or 4 years in a row. And I remember his mum coming up to me 1 year before a game and just pleading, just saying, please don't hit my boy this time. He's got another game tomorrow that he wants to play. And I think I hit him flush in the thigh and he was off for the fourth year in a row. And that was probably the first time where I thought,
yeah,
okay. But again, I mean, you get in the side, you're not meant to rub it, but he retired hurt.
Oh, I mean, it's funny you say that though, Pat, because you know, there's this phenomenon in Australian cricket where, like, if it didn't happen at home, then it didn't happen when it comes to the test side. And you're sort of poised as it stands to play your first test in Australia. So people want to know what you're actually like. And so what I want to know is when that mum said to you, please don't hit my boy, what were you actually thinking deep down? Were you thinking, oh, I'm definitely going to hit him now? Or are you actually nice?
He's not going to get one in his half.
I think it goes back to the old kind of tail end of rule. It's all fun and games, but if they hit a run off you, or you know, especially if it's a boundary, it's all bets are off. You're straight into it. So I can't quite remember, but I'm sure that would have been the way. If you survive the first couple of balls, it's a free for all.
Pat, I think there's going to be probably a lot more questions on speed throughout this, so we'll skip over that just for one moment and move a little bit forward. Look, you were playing test cricket at the age of 18. I was working at IGA part-time at the same time. You had a Cricket Australia contract. So can you kind of run us through, I guess, what happened between, or I guess in the weeks leading up to, finding out that you were going to play test cricket? I mean, were you playing great at the time? Or because I think you might have played a couple of Shield games, but not a lot.
Yeah, it's kind of the start of a new season where I played for Australia. So the season before, I'd literally started from round one. That was my first game in first grade. And then pretty much straight after Christmas, I played in the Big Bash. And then played three Shield games. And then yeah, then got a Cricket Australia contract and did my first off season with the Blues, and then yeah, there's a tour to South Africa. So pretty much in the space of 6 months, I suppose, I graduated from school and yeah, became an Australian contracted cricketer. So it was pretty cool. I mean, my first memories were going on tour with, you know, Ricky Ponting, Mike Hussey, Michael Clarke, Brad Haddon, these guys that I'd, you know, grown up for 10, 15 years watching and idolising. Suddenly I was, you know, having change room banter with them. Well, I wasn't really talking much, but it was, yeah, it was, I mean, it's just a pretty cool situation to be in. And I think even when I was over there, it was, you know, my whole thought process was, why the hell am I over here? I shouldn't be over here hanging out with these guys.
Did they welcome you with open arms? Was it a welcoming environment on that first time you walked into the test change room?
And who was most enthusiastic about showers?
Probably Mitchell Johnson. He's the strongest person in the team. Strongest, best rig. New tattoos for sure. But no, I mean, that's the weirdest thing. You go into a, you know, going from fourth grade into the third grade side, you feel like it's, you know,
you didn't play third grade. You went straight from fours to twos.
But if you go skip a grade, you feel like, you know, if someone speaks to you at all, you've had a good day out. So they get into the, you know, dressing room and, yeah, they're asking questions and speaking to you was pretty cool.
So Pat, that was back in 2011. Your test debut in Joburg. I'm telling you, as if you have never been asked this before, but are you in many ways sort of over talking about that? You must be itching to play Test Australia, because you've obviously played all of your tests away from home. But obviously that first test match was so explosive and so memorable for so many reasons. But specifically for you, 6 for 80 odd in the third innings of the test match, and then hitting the winning runs. Are you almost excited to, like, put that behind you now and start a new chapter of your test career playing at home?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think playing a couple of tests this off-season's probably been the first time where, I guess I haven't had to only refer to the Joburg test as my only test, which has been a big change on the last 6 years. So in some ways, I feel like a totally different cricketer in person, because it was so long ago. I was 18, and I just feel like I've, you know, grown up a bit and played a bit more cricket and done some things. So it's kind of weird talking about that game and how it went, because it does feel like so long ago, and forget about a lot of it. So I'm just pumped to get back into playing Australia. You grow up watching, you know, all the big test matches each summer. It's going to be pretty cool to be part of that.
Pat, speaking on behalf of people who follow England in London, I would guess that they're very afraid of you. Well, I know that many of them are very afraid of you. Can you just address them now and tell them what they can expect from you this summer, mainly with through the prism of fright and fear?
Well, the first thing you can expect is that its first test is in November. So all three, Starkey, Hazelwood and I, are going to don some Mo's as a nod to the late, great retired player, Mitchell Johnson, as of about a year ago. That's the first thing. Other than that, I don't know, hopefully a bit of aggression, a bit of hostility,
I feel like we've just swept over this. So you're going to have a moustache. I mean, I don't know why it's taken us so long to get to this, but you've got some of the purest, bluest eyes I've ever seen, and you're going to fashion a moustache come the first test match. Is that what we're hearing here?
Yeah. It was a one-in-all-in situation. So I think Hazelwood was the first one to crumble. And then kind of Starkey and I agreed along with him. So, yeah.
What kind of moustache are you thinking of going with? There's obviously a lot of, like, different
Gatsby
varieties.
Handlebar.
Gatsby. Fred Demon Spofforth.
Well, I don't think I have as many options open to me as someone like Mitchell Johnson did. He had the big handlebars. I think I've got the stock standard I don't even know who's
hipster.
Charlie Chapman. That's it.
Like John Captain Cleese, Mannering from Dead's
Army. That's the only
one I've got. There's a famous figure in the world that modelled his moustache on Charlie Chapman, but I don't think we'll go there. But with that in mind, Pat, I thought we'd move on to throwdowns. And I suspect you won't have listened to one show of The Great Cricketer, so just to explain it, we'll ask you a couple of questions where really the joke is wrapped up in the question and there's not really a lot you can say. But so really they're just self-serving. But does anyone want to volunteer to start off first? Anyone got anything soft?
Yeah, I'll start off. Let's go and then I'll start off. Pat, I want to know, I'll give you some numbers. You tested Boot in November 2011 in Joburg. Your figures of 6 for 79 in the third inning, 13 not out batting at number 10 with Mitchell Johnson to chase down 310 to win the match and tie the series. Did you think about retiring?
Yeah. Well, I thought I was retired there for about 6 years.
It's not funny. It's just, unfortunate.
Sorry about that.
Pat, look, I mean, you've obviously got a wonderful arm on you and you can field anywhere, but do you secretly harbour a desire to field in the cordon, specifically first slip?
Yeah, absolutely. I always wonder what they're talking about. It's normally where the best goss happens. And obviously the laziest fielders. So, yeah, of course, one day.
Well, you do everything else, I guess. Pat, at what point are you going to lose the plot when commentators continue to refer to you as Pat Cummings with an extra G?
I don't know. I might just walk off camera.
Well, it annoys. I can do that as proxy for you because it really does annoy me when people call you Cummings. It's just Cummins. Just read it. Read the name.
Yeah. I mean, Cummings isn't any more common than Cummins is it?
Really, exactly. I can feel it.
I want to ask you. It was actually Mickey Edwards who reported to us on this very podcast that your Australian and New South Wales teammate Mitchell Stark says when he's supporting his bowlers, send his bales to Wales. Can you confirm that he says that?
Yeah, he says that. He spends a lot of time with a pen and pad of paper working out what he's going to say. That's one of his latest.
Wow.
Wow.
Pat, you recently graduated from UTS with a Bachelor of Business, and congratulations on that first and foremost.
Thank you.
How many lectures did you actually go to?
Not many. I reckon I would have gone first semester. I was good. I started out going to most of them, and then I reckon I would have averaged maybe two a year for the next 5 years.
What's the number one thing you took away? I mean, from that degree, what's the number one thing you took away? What's the fundamental thing that you learned at university that will hold you true for life?
It's all available online, and you can Google these days.
Yeah.
That's probably the main thing.
That's my mantra, yeah. It's my tattoo.
Pat, I want to know, between South Africa 2011 and in 2016 when you came back into the ODI setup in Australia, did you wear your Australian tracksuit to the shops every day for 5 years to remind people that you played for Australia?
And the baggy green, yeah.
These are such unfair questions, aren't they? Yeah, all Pat can say is, great, got it. Yeah. So in that spirit... As Dave mentioned, Pat, you did recently graduate with a Bachelor of Business from UTS. You've also stated one of your favourite things to do is engage in crosswords. You also bowl at 155 kilometres an hour and have handsome features and really good, powerful levers. If you could only have one, what would you choose, a business degree or a phenomenal rig? You can only choose one.
There is a quick answer.
Yeah. Phenomenal rig, of course.
Correct, yeah.
You get the other grade quickly.
Everything I always thought, confirmed by an Australian test cricketer. Rigs equals everything.
Yeah, exactly.
I've got one more, Pat, and this will be the last one. We'll wrap it up here and just stay with it because it's fractionally long.
Pat, you're probably aware of recent ICC changes to the cricket laws. At least I hope you are. So this is a hypothetical and it's multiple choice. So, and I did mention this on the cast last week. So I just want your thoughts on this. Just picture this. It's day five at the SCG, fifth test versus England. The series is poised at 2-2. It's come down to the last over. Actually, let's call it the last ball. England need one to tie, two to win. Joe Root's on strike. He's on 145. Jimmy Anderson's at the non-striker's end. You've got six for, and you're at the top of your mark. David Warner comes over, and he says, Pat, Jimmy's creeping out of his crease here. Man-cat him. I'll say man-cat the prick. And then Steve Smith is kind of subtly fidgeting signals at first slip to the same effect. Second slip, sorry. So your leaders are telling you to do it. You charge in. Jimmy's clearly creeping out. Do you, A, contemplate the spirit of cricket and your brand legacy, deliver the ball to Root and risk losing matches for your country? B, nobly warn Anderson, who says thanks before you bolt to Root, Anderson cheats again anyway, and they scamper through for a single? Or C, aggressively man-cad Jimmy Anderson, sparking scenes of wild jubilation at the SCG, the whole country, and trigger non-violent riots in England?
I'm going for C, and I'm grabbing a stump with it and running around here. Easiest question of my life.
It's
just like a
run out,
isn't it, Nado?
Exactly.
It's just a run out. Yeah, it's just a
run out. I've got this image of Pat Cummins with a stump hoisted above his head, twirling it around the SCG while the crowd team follows him. The crowd's on the field, I think, at this stage.
Yeah, Shane Warne style, 700.
On the balcony at Lords. Nice.
Pat, that's fantastic. Thanks for being such a good sport with about half the questions that didn't allow you to answer them anyway. And thanks also for coming onto the show. We really appreciate it. And I guess on behalf of us and all the listeners, we're wishing you the best of luck for the upcoming Shield games and the Ashes as well. Go well. And yeah, I mean, if there's a man-cat in there, we'll claim it.
Yeah,
always claim it.
I'll see how I go.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks, boys. Appreciate it.
Cheers.
Cheers, Pat. Oh, look, I haven't changed my point of view on the matter. I said what I said a few years ago, and I guess at the moment he's obviously trying to sell a book, so it's amazing how more and more of the story comes out.
So are you two mates?
I think that's a bit of a stretch to say that we're mates.
Well, that's certainly what he's been saying.
Yeah, look, I think, as I said before, it's a bit of a stretch of the imagination, given that we've hardly spoken about since it all happened, and obviously haven't played since, you know, he took over as captain. But anyway, that's all old news now. So, as I said, I think it's more about him trying to promote his book through the summer.
Boys, we're at our final segment of this week's podcast, and it's the Ask TGC part of the show where you guys, the listeners, you get in touch with us during the week and you send us your questions, your comments, your deepest fears, all those insecurities. We love them. We embrace them. Keep sending them in with the hashtag AskTGC. You can get us on Twitter or Facebook at all the usual channels. This first one, lads, comes from GH Powell. This is via Facebook. Gents, when you compare current day players to those prior to the 2000s, having big pipes and a great rig to confirm your alpha status can only be a recent thing. Cricket prior to this seemed to be about who could drink the most beers the night before a game or who could grow the best moustache. Who do you blame for this? Bob Simpson?
Interesting question. Interesting question.
Can we can we account this to Bob Simpson, or do you think it came elsewhere, either pre-Bob or post-Bob?
Yeah, I mean, I was a bit rattled by G.H. Powell. It sounds like an author.
Literary.
So I was already intimidated by
and he asked about rigs.
Him or her. Yeah, well, I suppose like the implication in the question is that like as long as there's something, some status symbol you have to lord over your teammates, you're going to be on top. So in the sort of last century, it used to be drinking beers and moustaches. This century now it's pipes and rigs.
Yeah.
Bob Simpson. I mean, he was there sort of just toward the turn of the century, wasn't he? And that was when the Australian side, it was sort of the early to mid 90s. And that was when the Australian team started caring about things like fielding and one percenters and all these things that are kind of aligned with fitness and extras. So yeah, I'm actually prepared to blame Bob Simpson.
Yeah, so it's a trickle down rather than going up kind of thing. It started at the top and it's trickled its way down to grade cricket, or... I mean, I personally blame the metrosexual wave of the early 2000s, I think, because that's, to me, when male grooming and the rig fixation began.
Mm. But was Bob Simpson responsible for the metrosexual wave of the early 2000s?
No, John Buchanan
was. I think boy bands in the UK were. Oh, John Buchanan.
Agree to disagree.
But what was it like?
Three different suggestions.
But what about in Bradman's day? Like, why does his name escape me? Who was like who was the all rounder in Bradman's Invincibles tour?
Keith Miller. Keith Miller had the best rig, an amazing chest. He had a Brill Cream hairdo. He had a great tan. One of the best, like pre recoil as well. He just had a chest that you want to, you know, lie down and put your head on. I mean, I've always said that about Keith Miller. But he was probably the pin-up boy of the 1950s, and yeah, whatever.
I'm just wondering if it goes in waves then. So your chest and pipes cyclical. And levers were a 50s thing, and then it got back to beers and moustaches, and now we're going back to the Keith Miller era. Maybe this is all just retro.
You can't tell me Keith Miller didn't keep a lot of women warm at night on those boat trips over to England. You can't tell me he didn't.
Well, no, I can't. I can't and I won't.
I can't, he goes, I can't tell you that.
Lewis O'Brien's written in. G'day, lads. G'day, Lewis. Today I was cover driven for four by a number 10 who was wearing black runners. This was highly embarrassing, hence the DM. And resulted in half of my team falling over in fits of laughter. Where do I go from here? And is there any coming back from this? Thanks, asked TGC. Just from the top, Lewis, apologies if that wasn't meant to be read out to the 15,000 listeners that we have. I don't know how old Lewis is. This could. I think we should be careful. Firstly,
should we get our interns to screen those a bit more carefully?
I think. I think it probably takes great initiative to write it and try and find answers to these questions. I'm just quite nervous that you might be 14 years old and your friends are making fun of you now.
Well, fits of laughter are very difficult to recover from, aren't they? He goes.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, there is no coming back from this. In my last game that I ever played. A bowler, an off-spinner, no less, said to me, fucking shit shot. And I laughed internally. So, I mean, like, that's actually worse than your mates laughing at you. So don't worry, Lewis. It only gets worse.
Very good. This one, lads, we'll move on to James Holder, still via Facebook. He says, I'm a UK-based club cricketer, and like any self-respecting lower middle-order batsman, I firmly believe that the more you spend on kit, the greater the likelihood of a strong 30-odd season average. That's very true. For years, I've religiously used Kookaburra or Grey Nichols, obviously never in combination. However, I recently turned 34, and I've started to wonder if I should now switch to a little-known third-tier subcontinental manufacturer, as seems to be the common practice for professional players in their mid-30s, no doubt also looking for an excuse that isn't failing eyesight, slowed reactions, completely broken spirit. What are TGC's thoughts on this? Boys, he's considering at the age of 34 switching to a little-known third-tier subcontinental manufacturer. Would you advise this?
Never.
I think the pivot to Asia is a good one. I mean, Obama tried that and it was very successful, so why not pivot to Asia in cricket?
Nah, sorry, lads, I'm not having it. Like, the whole thing in cricket is to look good, and no one's ever looked good with Asian kit. Be good or fuck off. Next question.
I'm just trying to think of
next question
that looks good. Sorry, carry on. Luke Quinn Liven. Next question. An influential senior executive has taken an interest in me at work for no apparent reason. He recently dropped into conversation that his teenage son is having a good start to the summer in a local junior competition affiliated with my grade club. Although ineffective, the club website names me as a committee member, and I think I am being groomed to cheat his son into Green Shield for next season. I've checked my cricket and the kid is garbage. Is there any way out for me, or will this cruel irony see my mediocre grade career be the reason for my corporate dreams to get crushed too?
Oh, my God. There's a lot at play here, isn't there? He's obviously caught in the social crosshairs, work and cricket intersecting. As soon as you read that out, it reminds me actually of the Stonecutters Simpsons episode where Monty Burns has like a lower ranking on the pecking order to Lenny and Carl. So they can boss him around during these secret society meetings. So this bloke, obviously Luke's this influential senior executive who's his boss, he's trying to compel you, yet you hold the cards when it comes to his son's cricketing future. So maybe it's best just to avoid any form of cricket chat with him, I think. Eventually he'll get the hint that it's about merit, and if his kid's old enough, he's good enough.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's... Yeah, it's just a huge political play going on here from Luke's boss already. And if Luke doesn't promote his kid into Green Shield, then he will be fired, I think, and his career will be dead. So it is, it's quite the conundrum for him. I mean, the question is, what do you care about more, your club's Green Shield season or your career?
Mm. Well, I think, you know, unfair dismissal laws. I mean, we've got to consider unfair dismissal laws. You can't do that. I don't think Fair Work Australia would uphold that.
Great cricket is like the mob, is what I was going to say. Like you can leave, but you never get out. Like you're never out, are you? And there's just always a way to reel you back in. And this is another way that like Luke's experiencing that right now. You can never get out.
So let's just want to stick with this for a second. Like hypothetically, if Luke decides to promote this influential senior executive's son into the Green Shield side, what does that spell for Luke in terms of his club cricket political aspirations? Can he expect to be ostracised as well? Can people, you know, can he show his face at club cricket if they say, how did you put little Miles in his side? He can barely hold a stick.
It's tough, isn't it? I mean, his only solution is to leave clubs, just like his only solution is to leave jobs. So he's either way, he's got to leave.
He's leaving. Run away.
Pack bags, leave.
Run away from everything. Boys, this next one is actually from an anonymous contributor. He or she says, and probably, it's probably he because he says, one of the boys I play threes with has a habit of not playing with a straight bat when it comes to monogamy. He's engaged, so obviously this is not on, and it makes those of us who know feel quite uncomfortable. Further to this, however, he's our keeper and dropped a couple of regulation nicks off my bowling throughout the English summer just past. This enraged me far more than his tendency to go home with women from nightclubs instead of his fiance. Is this bad or is this just cricket? It's a challenging question that I put to you, boys.
Yeah, this feels like a throwdown where like the question is more about the person asking it rather than actually like asking for advice. He knows the answer.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the truth sort of comes out at the end of the question as well. Like he sort of spends a lot of time saying how uncomfortable he is with his friend cheating on his missus before he essentially admits that a dropped catch upsets him more. So yeah. Yeah, I mean, should you feel bad about that? Yeah, probably.
Yeah, you should. I mean, look, I mean, it's not just great cricketers, but society in general, and it's a sad indictment that, you know, brilliant people, be they cricketers, movie stars, whatever, some can get away with this kind of thing because they're brilliant at what they do. And he's saying that this guy does this, but he's not brilliant at cricket, so it's very difficult for him to forgive that. I think the answer at the end of the day is, yes, this is bad, and it's not restricted to cricket. There are bad people everywhere because, you know, that's just society. Next one, boys, we're moving into Twitter now. This one is from Chris Harris. He says, what do great cricketers think of Shire's cricket in Sydney? Now, boys, I know you have strong opinions on this.
Oh yeah. Well yeah, I'll just let the steam billow from my ears first before I answer.
You can see the vein in your forehead through this grainy scripe video.
What do great cricketers think of Shire's cricketers? I'll try and be positive. The only service that Shire's cricket offers is an outlet for great cricketers to say that they were offered money by a club to play.
I played one game of Shires a few years ago. I think I just returned from like a stint traveling, I think in the States and South America. So I hadn't like seen a cricket ball in 9 or 10 months. And I just thought that I would waltz in and just hit 100 and, you know, be the toast of the town. Obviously, I got a duck and was forced to watch my teammates just cash in on just rubbish bowling on the biggest road I've ever experienced. Try on over Linfield. So what I'm saying is maybe we shouldn't be underestimating Shires. You, me, he goes, we all sneer at it through our grade-skewed lenses, but maybe, I don't know, maybe there's a little bit more to it than we think, or maybe not.
I have nothing further to add because I don't think about it.
Well, sorry, he goes, I'll press you on that because, well, no, hang on, you live with a Shires cricketer.
He's behind you right now, isn't he?
He's in your house.
I can
at
see
moment,
him in the background.
Yeah. I don't know what you want me to do with that.
So hang on, you're prepared. You're literally prepared to comment on like a Ben Stokes like assault case, but you won't make a negative comment about Shire's cricket because of your housemate.
Yeah, well, he's actually paying my rent this month, so
I'm good for it.
Please buy the book. Well, it's been another fantastic podcast, chaps. I've very much enjoyed. Pat Cummins was a highlight for me so far this summer of the two podcasts we've had between Ed Cowan and Pat Cummins. Pat was absolutely fantastic. You know what? So was Ed. And so was Andrew Wu today. Fantastic chat with him as well. Our social medias, you know where we are, Facebook, Twitter. We're also on Instagram now. A lot of people don't know that, but we are on Instagram if you want to join us there. Perhaps some more personal stuff on Instagram if you fancy following us there as well. Obviously, the book's out. You know where to get it from, all the usual places. If you want to sponsor this podcast, by the way, you can get in contact with us. You can email us, and you can find how to do that on the internet very easily on our social medias. And if you want us to host an event for you as well, we are also doing that, live events. We're going to be doing that as well this summer. So it's been an absolutely fantastic show. Thanks for tuning in again. We're going to see you next week. Cheers.
Cheers.